So the example we're going to start with we have a particle moving on a circle. And then we gauge the rotational symmetry of the target. So the gauge symmetry the rotation sends phi to phi plus some constant. Nice, I'm just rotating it around the circle. So the covariant derivative is d t phi is this, where I've added on the gauge field. It's an additive constant. Of course, if you were to exponentiate it, it would be multiplicative, but it's additive because this rotation adds a constant to my field. So the action so where would such a thing come from? You know, of course, I've written this as a one-dimensional particle. Phi only depends on time and doesn't depend on space at all. But if it did depend on space, then this would be exactly what you'd find in the Higgs mechanism. Like phi, you know, in the Higgs mechanism, if I have this potential like this, there's a zero kind of minimum of the potential, which is this circle, and the field can move around in that circle. It's called the Goldstone boson. And you know, there's a U1 gauge field, which is this, and coupled exactly like this, and you notice if we expand it out, we get this quadratic term. So there's the gauge field gets a mass. So this is it's obviously a very physically relevant system, and we're going to study the phase space in this simple case where everything does not depend on space and only depends on time. And then we can move on to reintroduce spatial dependence. So the phase space is always equal to the space of solutions to the equations of motion modulo gauge. So what's that? If we vary phi, we find that the covariant derivative squared of phi is equal to 0. So this gives the usual phase space. So I'll come back, in one moment, I'll say what happens in vary A, but let's just focus on this for now. The usual phase space with coordinates Q equals P equals phi and P equals derivative of phi. We note the action can be written in the first order form. Integrate out P, we get okay. So the reason I want to do this, I want to write it in the first order form, is I want to highlight the way in which the gauge field couples to some particular function on the phase space. And so the function in this case P that couples to AT is called moment map. So I wanted to highlight this part because we'll want to study more general systems where the thing that couples to the gauge field plays a very important role. So now let's look at what happens when we vary A. I vary the gauge field in the second order formulation. You can see from that expression, we find that the covariant derivative phi is zero, or if you look from the first order, you find that P is zero. And of course, these are the same thing. Okay. So this is going to be a very general phenomenon. When I vary the gauge field, the time component of the gauge field, that's going to impose a constraint on the phase space, where whatever couples to that time component is set to zero. So if we do this, then the phase space looks like just S1 and coordinate Q. So, problem that this is not symplectic, obviously, because it's odd dimensional. But the solution is that I haven't really implemented what we were supposed to do. We're supposed to solve the equations of motion modulo gauge symmetry. Because gauge symmetry is a redundancy in the description of my system. So two points on the phase space, which are related by gauge transformations, should be thought of as the same. So once we implement that final step, we'll see in this case, we'll also get rid of the coordinate Q. So two points on the phase space, which are related by gauge symmetry, are the same. So what does gauge symmetry do? So infinitesimally, gauge symmetry transforms my gauge field. The variation of H of my gauge field is the derivative of the parameter of gauge transformations. And the variation of phi, I'm just going to add on this gauge. Because phi lives on a circle, I'm just going to move around that circle. So we can set AT to 0 by a gauge transformation. And then constant gauge transformations will set Q, i phi, to 0. So we conclude this system is trivial. Okay. So any questions?
So here are you varying the gauge field because it is dynamical?
Yes.
So why aren't we including its configurations in the phase space as well?
Yes. I wrote something wrong. And 80. So when we just study the equations of motion, the phase space consists of Q and this guy. But then when I do the next step of dividing by the gauge transformations, we get rid of both of those. Okay. So as we will see when we look at higher dimensional examples, what always happens is your gauge field will have time direction and a space direction. The time direction can be absorbed into the time dependence of the gauge transformation, but the space direction of the gauge field will leave something in the phase space. Now let's think about what happens when I'm on, if I take some general system and I want to couple it to a gauge field. Suppose M is a symplectic manifold. U is a function on M. And I want to say X mu is the corresponding vector field. And now let's suppose that the flows of X mu are periodic with period 1. Right, so when I follow this vector field around, I come back to where I started. So this means following these flows gives me an action of the group U1. So the previous example, M was R times S1 coordinates P and Q, mu was P, X mu was d by dQ. So what we'd like to do, so now we have, we're forgetting about the dynamics for now. We could include a Hamiltonian if we wanted to. Let's not for now. We want to study what happens when I couple this system to a U1 gauge field. Well, so in coordinates P and Q, the Lagrangian is integral PI of T dQI of T plus u . This is a Lagrangian. This is for a particle. Moving in M. So we're just doing the same thing we did before, really. If you recall, we had this procedure. If you give me a symplectic manifold and I write its symplectic form as D over one form, we can build a Lagrangian for a particle moving in the manifold. And you know, that Lagrangian describes the one-dimensional system associated to that symplectic manifold. So this is the Lagrangian when we couple to a gauge field. So this mu is what couples to AT. The gauge transformations are delta of P like this. And one can check that this whole thing is gauge invariant. Which I won't do right now. So what's the phase space? We vary, so P and Q are covariant constant. So they're determined by their values at the initial time. But if we vary A, we find that the moment map U is 0. So this is the key equation, and it's the same thing we had before. So the phase space is equal to the quotient of the set U equals 0 by the U1 action, which is generated by X mu. So you guys understand what I mean by the quotient? It's like we identify points if they're related by this U1 action. So actually, this is not actually really more complicated than what we had before. Is that locally, we can find coordinates so that, say, mu is p1 and x mu is d by dq1, and q1 is periodic. So in these coordinates, we remove p1 and q1. So what this procedure always does is it removes a canonically conjugate pair. So I have some pair of coordinates, p and q. I'm setting p to be 0. And it looks like this. And here is p equals 0. I'm setting p equals 0, and then I'm identifying points if they're related along the flows along this circle. So the result is, again, symplectic. So this procedure is called symplectic reduction. Let's see. Any questions about this intuition? So let's, if you guys are happy, I want to move on to discuss what happens in higher dimensions where the gauge field plays a more important role. We'll start with dimension 2. So the phase space of Yang-Mills theory on R times S1. This is coordinates t, this is coordinates theta. The action in dimension 2, this quantity here is the field strength of my gauge field. In dimension 2, because the field strength is an anti-symmetric tensor, and there's only two indices, it's a scalar. So I'm just taking the square of that scalar. But it's convenient to rewrite this. You know, in these phase space analyses, it's often helpful to write things in a first order formulation. is a scalar. So just like the same kind of thing we did before, integrating a B leads us to that action there. So the phase space is going to be the space of solutions to the equations of motion modulo gauge. So I'm going to take this action and I'll just solve the equations of motion. Before I do that, let's just look at this action for a minute. So this piece, B delta A theta, what does that tell us? Well, that looks a lot like P delta Q. So this tells us that B and A theta will behave like they're canonically conjugate. B will behave like momentum because of this B squared term. And what does this term here tell us? Well, the time component of the gauge field is always going to be what's related to the moment map. And that couples to the derivative of B, because I'm going to integrate by parts and move that over. So this will look just like a system where I have a P and a Q, and I'm gauging where the symmetry is the derivative in theta of P. Let me write that out. So this is how this looks like. This will be the moment map. So, I mean, you can kind of see just by looking at this what the phase space will look like. It'll look like the symplectic reduction of the phase space of a scalar field by this action. But we'll get to that. Okay. So, what do I get if I solve the equations of motion? You find if you vary a theta, you find you vary B, So this equation is like B is like momentum, momentum's conserved. This equation is going to be telling us about the Hamiltonian, I think. This equation is telling us that B is the time derivative of theta. And if we vary AT, which will give us the moment map equation. Which is delta theta B equals 0. And as usual, gauge transformations will set a t to be 0, leaving us with those gauge transformations chi theta, which only depend on theta. So if we look at the, if you look at the equation for varying b, it's nicer if I set a t to be 0. Then this set of equations just looks like I have a p and a q. P is the derivative of q, and I'm imposing a moment map equation. So that's, in sum, exactly what we find. So we conclude. So the phase space is the symplectic reduction of the phase space for a free particle, like a free scalar, with like p theta, q theta, where we reduce by the action. The only subtlety here is when I was dealing with just a particle, I just had a single copy of U1. But now I have a copy of U1 for every point in space. If gauge transformation is chi of theta, which with the moment map. Map d theta, d theta. Okay. So this acts because p and q are canonically conjugate. This is how the points in the phase space transform. Okay, everybody happy that this is what we get? Yeah.
Just to make sure, when you're setting at to be 0, is this just because of some cohomology, like h1 of r?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, that's a very fancy way of saying that every function on the real line has an antiderivative. Actually, this analysis applies with very little change in higher dimensions as well. Okay, so the final thing to do is actually implement these constraints. So p theta is constant say p, and also q theta is, well, when I do a gauge transformation I can add on any derivative I can add on any derivative of a function to Q. So this is gauge equivalent to a constant. To the integral of Q theta. So this quantity is gauge invariant, because when I add on a derivative, it doesn't change. Although there's a slight correction to that statement I'll say in a minute. So the phase space is actually two-dimensional with coordinates p of theta, which is independent of theta. But if we if we treat this with more care, there's a small subtlety I didn't mention. The subtlety is that because the gauge group is U1, I've only written down the equations for small gauge transformations. If we take into account the large gauge transformations, as I wind around the theta circle, my gauge transformation in U1 can have some winding number. If we take those into account, we find that the phase space, only the exponential of this is gauge invariant. And the phase space is R times S1. Okay, with the standard symplectic form. And the Hamiltonian is P squared. So I think I should stop there, but now I think you can see how to build the Hilbert space of two-dimensional Young-Mills. We know what the phase space is, we know what the Hamiltonian is. You can build the Hilbert space and the spectrum by looking at the Bohr-Sommerfeld orbits. There's a discrete spectrum where the eigenvalues are the squares of the integers. So it is, in fact, the same as a particle moving in the circle. Okay. And it's really fun to do this for non-abelian gauge theory. And there's all kinds of nice papers from the mid-80s where people studied it at a large N for UN gauge theory. I don't know if we can look at that, but. Any more questions?
So basically states are labeled by some kind of Wilson loop or?
Yeah, exactly. Q is, if we kind of unpack everything, Q is the theta component of the gauge field. Because if you remember, B and the theta component of the gauge field were canonically conjugate. So this is literally a Wilson loop going around space. And this P, canonically conjugate momentum, That's the field strength. So the things, the operators in the system, I measure the field strength at a point, and that by the Bianchi identity, it actually doesn't really matter where you put it. And like, or I can do a Wilson loop, and these are canonically conjugate. And that, of course, because p squared, because the square of the field strength appears in the action, it's natural that the Hamiltonian is p squared.
Can we do this the same thing for discrete gauge fields?
Yes, but it'll be much simpler. You'll just find, what am I saying? In a purely discrete gauge field, the phase space will not have any continuous directions at all. It will just be like a bunch of points labeled by the possible fluxes of my gauge field. So it's not necessarily that useful a way to think about it.
And even with a couple to matter, it also just be copies of the...
No, when coupled to matter, yes, then that's definitely more interesting. Suppose I had some matter system which had a phase space and I coupled to a discrete gauge field. What would I get in the new system? Well, at a first pass, you should just divide by the gauge transformations. Now, the moment map equation is going to be trivial because that comes from like the infinitesimal gauge transformations. So I'm just going to be dividing by the gauge transformations. But I think maybe a more refined analysis by looking at the equations in motion might tell you that if I have a discrete gauge field, I can have some winding number going around the circle. And that might give you something, that will give you something else. So this, you get a phase space, which is a bunch of pieces corresponding to the winding modes, and on each piece, you have to divide by a certain group. And this is what's called the orbifold procedure for 2D CFTs.